Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and the Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and advocate for the eco-socialist program that my running mate Angela Walker and I ran on in 2020. And today, actually yesterday, was the 13th anniversary of the Syrian uprising for bread and freedom that began on March 15th, 2011. And we have a guest that's going to speak to that and also the Palestinian struggle, Nidal Buttari. What began as nonviolent protests in Syria soon were violently suppressed by the forces of the Assad regime, and the conflict became a bloody civil war with military intervention from countries around the world, including the US, Russia, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and others. But the underlying issues of repression and poverty remain today. So resistance continues in Idlib province in the Northwest and in the Kurdish majority Northeast. These are areas the Syrian government still doesn't control. And where people have the opportunity, opposition keeps arising. In the last 9 months, there's in particular been protests by the Druze community in southern Syria, which before now had stayed out of the conflict. And that led to related protests in the southern province of Daraa, which is where the uprising began 13 years ago. So on this anniversary of the Syrian uprising, and while the destruction in Gaza continues, I think it's a good time that we bring a guest who can speak to these freedom struggles in both Syria and Palestine. Nidal Buttari is a Palestinian refugee who grew up in the Yarmouk refugee camp in Syria. And he participated in the Syrian uprising, and he's active in the Palestinian freedom movement. He's based in Washington, D.C. with People Demand Change, which is an international development and aid organization that works particularly with grassroots groups and civil society in the Middle East and North Africa. He earned a master's in political sociology from Damascus University in 2010, and then managed the Iraqi refugees program in Syria until January 2012, when what was going on in Syria led him to move to Lebanon, where he worked as a project coordinator in the Arab NGO Network for Development in Beirut. He also worked as a journalist and researcher with National Public Radio's Beirut office and with other news outlets and websites in the Arab world in the US. And we'll put in the chat an article that Nidal wrote a few years ago about his life in a politically active family of Palestinians in Syria that includes his participation in the uprising 13 years ago. And we'll also link to his organization, People Demand Change. So welcome, Nidal. I'm really glad to have you here today. So, you know, tell us about the Syrian and Palestinian freedom movements and how we got to the situations we're in today.
Well, thank you very much, Howie, and for hosting me. You know, people, when I came here to the U.S., in 2013, and I started meeting people who are interested in the politics in the Middle East and the revolutions and the uprising that erupted in 2011, I figured out that people really do not know that much about the Palestinian Nakba, about 1948, the established. They know that it was the establishment of Israel, but they really do not know the consequences of what happened. And very, very, very few people who I met that knew that there were about 500,000 Palestinian refugees that resided in Syria. And they were the generations who grew up, were born and grew up in Syria because of 1948 Nakba. So I grew up in relatively camp. I'm saying relatively camp because it was a neighborhood. And it was the biggest camp for Palestinian refugees in the Middle East. So it was about 150,000 Palestinian refugees, but the population of that neighborhood was about 1 million. And the 850,000 population, other than the Palestinians, they were all Syrians. So you can just imagine how close Palestinians and Syrians, and at least in my neighborhood, lived in Syria. That being said, the Palestinians in Syria since 1948 became part of... It is very hard to say that they were part of the social fabric of the in Syria, because we were still refugees. I was born in Syria, I was raised in Syria, but I've never been Syrian. I've never been granted Syrian citizenship, for example. I always had temporary residency in Syria. So by today's Western definition or the international community definition, I am stateless. So I was born stateless. I grew up stateless. And I came here to the United States stateless. But this statelessness did not mean that we did not interact with the Syrians. So we became part of the socio-economic movement in Syria, and also part of the political movement in Syria. And I'm gonna talk more about the political movement in Syria down the road now when we're talking. So 500,000 Palestinians, 500 according to UNRWA, actually, in 2011, about 535,000 Palestinian refugees, registered Palestinian refugees, lived in Syria in the 12 camps. And these camps were spread all over the entire country, mostly. And as I said, the biggest one was my neighborhood, El Yarmouk camp, which was like, I'm not going to go into details, but the UNRWA categorized it as an official camp, whatever it means. But it was a Palestinian camp. It had 150,000 Palestinian refugees and 850,000 Syrians. And it had the whole political structure of the Palestinian movement. So when I'm saying the whole political structure of the Palestinian movement, I'm saying the whole structure that was evolved and developed over the decades from 1948 until actually today. So it means that the Palestinians in Syria, they were part of the of PLO movement when it started in the 50s, and then they became part of the mostly all the Palestinian factions who were established and dismantled either by others or just dismantled themselves because they don't do anything anymore. But Palestinians in Syria, as any other society or Palestinian gathering in Lebanon, in Jordan, in West Bank, in Gaza, inside the Palestinians in Israel, we were part of the socio-economic or the Palestinian political structure, but we were part of the socio-economic structure of the host countries, which mainly means that after 1948, there were the host countries for Palestinians, which was Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and the refugees who were displaced in the historic Palestine to Gaza and to West Bank. And these were the areas where UNRWA also function. So that being said, I was born in 1979, like the year where Camp David Accord happened, and under the rule of Al-Ba'ath Party in Syria, which was led by back then Hafez al-Assad, and who staged a coup in Syria in 1970 and called it the Correction Movement. And this Correction Movement was part of movements that was happening in the Middle East and North Africa back then, that brought a new leaders to the region. So Hafez al-Assad came that year in 1970. Al-Gaddafi in Libya came also the same year. Most of the Arab leaders who like came from in the 70s came like in 1970. Anwar Sadat came back then after Jamal Abdel Nasser was died in 1970. So there was a movement, a whole movement in the whole Middle East and North Africa countries that brought Hafez al-Assad to power. And it was part basically from the Arab nationalist movement that dominated the region for a very long time. And since it was like these regimes, like Hafez al-Assad regime and the regimes in Egypt, Yemen, in Libya, they were all part of the Arab nationalist movement. So for them, Palestine was an essential cause, as they called it, which means that Palestine is the central foreign policy issue for any country in the Middle East and North Africa, which is also known as some part of it known as the Arab world. Unfortunately, this did not have good impact on the Palestinians and their movement, nor had good impact on the peoples in the region, because what happened that the Palestinian cause was twisted politically and militarily and used as a tool to control the peoples of the region. And one of the very if I am an academic and I want to really write something about how the leaders in the region use the Palestinian cause to rule their countries, Syria is a very good case study to do that. So because Hafez al-Assad, what he did in the 70s, that he created and split and divided and unified and divided again the whole Palestinian movement. So as you may know and others know, the Palestinian movement or liberation movement started big part of it was located outside of occupied Palestine. It didn't start basically. It was like it started in Syria and Jordan and Lebanon from what we used to call it in the Palestinian literature, the attempt to liberate from outside the borders before. So this phase lasted from 1948 until Oslo Accords in the early 90s. Between 1948 and Oslo Accords, all these years the Palestinians in Syria lived under the rule of the dictatorship Hafez al-Assad. And what Hafez al-Assad did after he staged the coup, he wanted basically, I like to usually to use this metaphor, like, you know, the movement that, or the coup that Jamal Abdel Nasser staged in Egypt, and he kicked away the king. Hafez al-Assad and his crew in the Syrian army, which was a new army back then, it tried to copy this this model and to kick what they used to call the imperialist or the imperialist or the collaborators with imperialism, and to bring socialist party to rule the country, and they promised prosperity to the Syrian people. But what happened is that al-Assad, Hafez al-Assad, the father, what he did in the first 5 years of his life, that he consolidated power in his hands. He dismantled all the political parties that they were part of the political movement in Syria since liberation from colonialism, the French colonialism in 1945. He canceled them. He put them in a prison. Even his friends who helped him with the coup, some of them, they did not approve his policies. So he put them in a prison, or they just disappeared. Some of them, they were mysteriously assassinated. So what he did, he cleaned around him, and he stayed on power for like from 1970 to 2000 when he died. I think 2000 when he died in June 2000. For 30 years, he was the solo power in Syria, and he created inside Syria, or he turned the country into a farm for his family, for his brothers, for his sons and daughter, and their relatives. So they consolidated the power, and they turned the army into a institution that is designated to support Hafez al-Assad and his power and his oligarch around him. And he completely dismantled any possibility for the Syrian people to produce socioeconomic system that it is livable for them. So in 2000, he died in June, and then his son, Bashar al-Assad, inherited power from his father by the support of the oligarchs who were around his father. He was 34 years old, and he studied in England. So people, like some people, perceived him as a young person. And then he gave a long speech in the parliament and he promised a lot of promises to the Syrian people. He promised that he's going to change the situation, that he's going to get rid of the old guards, which means like his father's ruling class. And he's gonna rebuild the economy, and he's gonna change the security mentality of the state, because it was a security state. He gave a lot of promises, but one detail, one very 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 small detail happened that for me personally, I felt, I am not Syrian, but I felt humiliated on behalf of my fellow Syrians, my friends. The Syrian constitution stated back then that to be a president, you have to be at least 40 years old. Bashar al-Assad was 34. So the old guard and the oligarchs around him, who would be promised that he's gonna get rid of them, they changed the constitution in the parliament in 5 minutes, and changed that the age of the president, so from 40 to 34. So basically what they say, they changed the part in the constitution about the age of the requirement of the age of the president, and they made it 34. However, between 2000 and 2005, Bashar Assad tried to show that he is. Let me back up a little bit. I was saying that people thought that he's gonna be like he's young and educated in the West, and they thought that he's gonna really change the situation. But I missed something, that it was also generational. So for my generation, all I remember it very well, like when we were at the university, I was back then at the university, the sociology department, and I was sitting with my friends in the cafeteria of the university, and they were really talking about it, and they felt humiliated, like they were like young people, guys in their 20s, and they felt, what, how on earth that this could happen, that Syria would be like a person, the constitution would be changed in the parliament in 5 minutes, and this guy would inherit and rule us. Why? Although some other people, the older generation, like my father's generation, and the generation who even resisted Hafez al-Assad in the 60s and 70s, they thought, let's give it a shot with him and see. So he opened kind of what we used to call back then debate clubs, and that gave kind of like a little bit of freedom of expression for people to talk about the economy, to talk about reforms, to talk about the changes and the mentality of the mindset of the institutions, and to change the security state into more developed and improve and to that respect its people. But it did not last that long. In 2005 or 2006, between 2005 and 2006, Bashar al-Assad and the security services cracked down on all the people who he let them talk, let them speak, and gave them the platforms to give opinions. And he arrested them. I can count and remember, I was like starting my master's back then, 2006. I can remember how, like, I can really count maybe 5 or 6 of my very close friends who were arrested, taken from the university and thrown into jails. And some of them never survived, and some of them, they were released in 2011 when the revolution started in Syria. And why did he crack down on these movements? Because 30 years of building institutions of the state to make its behavior, the state's behavior, bureaucratic and automatic, could not be changed in 2 or 3 years. And could not be changed by him. And it will not be changed because he came with the same mentality of his father, the same mentality of being a dictatorship. One of the arguments, like one of my friends back then, he said, okay, if the older generation, they won't want to give him a shot. Why? If they think that he was educated in the West and he came here double or whatever, and he's a doctor, why doesn't he go and open a clinic and work as a doctor? If he really does believe in democracy and the human rights, why would he become the president? So, and it's like he rightly put it, because you don't, if you really believe in democracy, you don't force yourself, impose your ideas, impose your ideology on people. You let people choose. But no, basically, Bashar al-Assad was raised, born and raised for a father who is dictatorship, and he was raised and grew up watching his father and his father's friends and the crew and oligarchs behaving in certain way, and he just copied his father's behavior to his and brought it to his presidency. So he cracked down on all the reforms that he promised, and even more, he did worse. What he did is that he made the Syrian economy like really like you a slimy economy. You really don't have a description for it. It's not socialist. It's not capitalist. it's nothing. He opened the economy, and he opened the economy basically to Turkey, to Erdogan. And the middle class in Syria started to shrink rapidly, and especially in the suburbs. I'll give one example. So, for example, the furniture industry in Syria, it was very localized, and in the rural areas in Damascus and Aleppo. What Bashar al-Assad did is that he opened the furniture market to the Turkish products, and the Turkish products completely flood the Syrian market, and caused the closure of a lot of small businesses furniture industry businesses in rural Damascus. So this is only one example, and you can really apply it on everything. And by shrinking the middle class and shrinking the small businesses, then the oligarchs around him started also like to shrink and to make to be closer. And the whole economy of the country in 2011 was really consolidated in the hands of Bashar al-Assad, his wife, and his cousin, and a few other cousins of and his brother, and a few other people in his family. So it's not only consolidated in the family of Bashar al-Assad and his wife, it was consolidated in the hands of certain people in his family. And this is why when the Syrian revolution, the uprising started, it was very popular. It was really popular. It started everywhere. It did not like, seriously, and I'm really honest about this, the West, it tried, and they describe it at when it started from the beginning as a sectarian civil war. But believe me, I can count in my head now the people who I know that started to go into protest, like very peaceful protest, and none of them is, and they are from different sects and from different ethnicities. They are like, they were Kurds, and they were Arabs, and they were Alawites, and they were Durzi, and they were Christians, and they actually like the leaders of the movements of the resistance movements to Bashar, to Hafez al-Assad, and then later to Bashar al-Assad, like there were a lot of them, they were Alawites and from minorities in Syria. But the outside, the impact of the Arab countries and the Gulf countries into the Syrian revolution, this is another subject we might comment to later, like had like really bad and negative impact. However, what I wanted to say is that the Syrian uprising, when it started, there were reasons. So if you want to say that there are three factors for any uprising, one of them might be the political factor, and the other one is economic factor, and the third one is social factor. Like, so if one in Syria, three of them, they came together and they created an impossible situation for the Syrian people to live, even to live, to survive on a daily life. This is why people really started the revolution. I was working on a research the other day that about the terminology of the revolutions in the Arab world or in Middle East and North Africa. And I was writing the introduction of it. So I wrote that when it's not published yet, but well, I came to this conclusion. So I was writing Bouazizi in Tunis, he burned himself because he was humiliated. He was slapped in the face and pushed to the ground and beaten by police. And the first protest in Syria, it started because a policeman hit a man who was trying to park his car in the middle in the street. So the policeman, he attacked him and he slapped him on the face. And in Egypt, this guy or kid, his name Khaled Saeed, he was going to an internet cafe and the police pulled him out and they just started to beat him to death and they killed him. In the three cases, it really never crossed my mind that in the three cases in the whole revolutions in the region started because of humiliation and because of oppression. And this is what dictatorship means, basically, because the dictatorships, they are coercive regimes. They impose their rules on you and you don't dare to say no, and no means that you are going to prison and you might most likely lose your life in the prison. And this is what happened during, like, in the whole Arab region, actually, not only in Syria. And this is why the region erupted, like the revolutions in the region erupted. There was kind of interconnectivity between the revolutions in the Middle East and North Africa, between Syria and Egypt and Bahrain and etc. Because there is a mindset in that region that was created in the 70s due to the Arab ban or Arab nationalism movements that created these dictatorships. And the Palestinians, they were all the time part of these movements. And their cause was always the main tool that the Arab regimes used to rule their people. So I'm going to give an example here so people understand what I'm talking about. Because of the Palestinian cause, most of the Arab countries, they declared martial rules and they ruled their people for 20, 30, 40 years and let them under the martial rules. And this happened in Syria. And in Syria, they called the emergency declaration rules. So basically, Hafez al-Assad in the 70s, when he came to power, he declared emergency. And when you declare emergency, it means that you are dismantling the capacity and the capability of all the institutions, especially the judiciary institutions in your country, to act as they act in normal or behave in normal situation. So basically, any cop in the street can just pull you back, pull you from your sweatshirt and t-shirt and throw you in the prison for years and years and years without going to trial. To an extent that there was, like, maybe we used to joke about that, but it was not really a joke that in Syria there is a phobia. And this phobia is that you are always worried that while you're walking in the street freely, someone's gonna pull you from your t-shirt and throw you in the jail. And it was, and now I remember after years on and after the uprising, I understand it more and more, which really we had this phobia. And we created sayings around this phobia, like saying walls have ears. You cannot talk about the regime. You cannot talk about the security. You cannot talk about corruption. You cannot talk about democracy. You cannot call for elections. You cannot call for even elections for in the parliament. You cannot call for reforms. You cannot correct things because the president is the god. He is the first, he is the big father of the country. And when I say the big father, they literally use these terms and they wrote it on banners and panels across the streets that they are the only ones who know your interests. You as a citizen, you don't have even like this. They the term citizen and citizenship is twisted in a very sick way under these regimes. All that to say, Howie, that the life under dictatorship is just impossible. It's just impossible. People, it worries me, and like it worries me today here in the United States, to be honest with you. Because at least what happened with Syria. Syria is the example where you see the whole world really collapsing. The international community and the system, the global system that was born and created after World War II, is chaotic now. We don't have standards. We don't have norms. It is very hard to convince people to these days about what's right and what's wrong, although the right is very clear or the wrong is very clear. When you reach the point that you have to convince people that killing civilians is wrong and it should not happen, and when you have massive movements on massive communities, societies, thinkers, journalists, politicians, they really believe that killing civilians is okay. I don't know what kind of war that we're living. And Syria was when all our beliefs in the Western norms of democracy, human rights, et cetera, like really, we saw it collapsing altogether in Syria. The United Nations collapsed in Syria. The democracy and the human rights collapsed in Syria. And what we are seeing today in Gaza is just the consequences of the Western and the international community's behavior in Syria, because Netanyahu is nothing less than Bashar al-Assad. Netanyahu is just a dictatorship, and he is willing to go to a third war to just stay in power. And this is what he's doing. And this, I'm not justifying on saying what Hamas did not do anything. No, Hamas is the product of Bashar al-Assad. Hamas is the product of Netanyahu. They work together. I call them the triangle. Like the triangle of Netanyahu, Bashar al-Assad, and Hamas, they cannot live without each other. They need each other to survive because they have the same mindset. They have the same mentality. They have the same way of thinking that people should be ruled by force, by an iron fist. And this is what they're thinking. And we, as Palestinians in Syria, as a group of 500,000 Palestinian refugees in Syria, we lived through what the Syrians lived, although we had some extra thing that Bashar al-Assad brought Hamas and created, strengthened Hamas in 2000, and he started to Islamize the Syrian society, the Palestinian society, and he started to give them platforms and make them to expand on the advantage of other voices like us, the seculars, or like people who really started to believe that at some point we should live in peace. No one's going anywhere. We have to find a way to live together in that region. But dictatorships are dictatorships. They build their tools in their hands and they use it. And this is what happened with Hamas. And this is what also Netanyahu did to Hamas. He opened, like, since 2006 or 7 when he came to power, he just opened the whole economy to Hamas and their leaders, not to Gazans. Let's just like really be clear about that. Hamas leaders, they used to enter their money, to enter the country, to leave the country, to buy houses, to live luxurious life, and to live the way they want to live while Gazans are starving, and all with the support of Netanyahu, and since he came to power. So now we are in this situation where Bashar al-Assad survived after 10 years because of the silence of the international community, and the Syrian and the Syrian population, half of them are inside Syria, half of them are either internally displaced or refugees. We don't know, by the way, how many Syrians lost their lives in Syria in this conflict, because the United Nations stopped counting in 2013, and the last number they reached, it was 300,000 Syrians lost their life in 2013. So just imagine how many people lost their lives now, that we don't know. And Putin is using this chaos to create his new global power, which is basically the axis of dictatorship that starts in Moscow. It goes through Ankara to Tehran to Damascus to Beirut and through the whole Gulf states and North Africa. So if people are worried about like the Third World War, I see that we are living it. But in like the wars are not the same. The traditional war is not the wars like countries do anymore these days. In Syria, you have the United States with a whole coalition that the United States is leading. You have the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and the Iranian militias. You have the Russians in Tartus city that they built a whole base. It's called Hamamin Base. And you have militias from everywhere. And you have Turks and Turkish army in the north. And so you have like 5 to 6 countries in this small country, or armies in this small country. So and they are fighting each other, and we cannot say otherwise. So if this is not a world war, so I don't know how we can describe it. And it's a world war on the expenses of one people. It's the Syrian people, and now it's expanding to be on the expenses of the peoples of the whole region, like the Syrian people and the Palestinian people and the Israeli people themselves, actually.
Let's get some questions, Nidal. That's a lot of things to mull over. Let me start. One of the things that you said, you know, a lot of this problem with the breakdown of the post-World War II norms, like in the UN Charter against aggression and the Human Rights Charter and so forth, really came apart during the Syrian conflict. And one of my frustrations here was that many people who call themselves on the left supported Assad, saying that I was actually in an interview with that guy that just got elected to the parliament in Britain. What's his name? George Galloway.
Oh.
And when I was running for president, he interviewed me, and you know, he wanted to try to get me to support the Russian intervention. He called all the Syrians head choppers. So they, you know, it was Islamophobia of all the Syrians. And a lot of people on the left here, I call them vulgar anti-imperialists, because they don't look at the concrete situation in each country. They just decide whatever position the U.S. has taken, we're going to take the opposite position. And then, you know, the other thing I'll just throw out here for your comment is, at the end of the year, December 28th, Sergey Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, was quoted in an interview saying that the objectives of Israel in Gaza are the same as Russia's objectives in Ukraine. And you mentioned how you mentioned the I guess the troika of Assad and Netanyahu and forget who the third was. But what people don't realize is that Russia and Israel have been allies. And I think the purpose, I mean, the question is, why did Lavrov made that statement and then RT International put it out to the international community? And you have to ask yourself why. I think part of it was signaling to the Israelis that we still have the relationship we had, one of which was Russia allowed Israel to bomb Syria where there were Iranian military assets. So they were militarily allied. And then the third thing I'll throw out there is another problem with the left here is they think Assad has supported the Palestinian liberation struggle, when in fact, you know, he devastated the Yarmouk refugee camp. So I'm just throwing out, you know, how frustrating it's been for those of us trying to be in solidarity with oppressed groups that we got a part of the left in the West that sides with the dictators, you know, Putin, Assad, you name it.
Let's start from where you ended, because I think this is the core of the division and the split and inside the left. The statement that Hafez al-Assad or Bashar al-Assad, for that matter, later on, supported the Palestinian liberation movement is the biggest lie in the history, that Hafez al-Assad tried to withdraw before, like in the 70s, 80s, 90s, across the world, that he is the protector of the Palestinian liberation movement. But let's see, let's just like, I'm gonna count for you a few things he did. So the first, in 1973, he destroyed one of the most vulnerable and poor camps for Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. It's called the Za'atar camp. Tell us Za'atar, and he massacred the Palestinians in Tell us Za'atar camp. And his argument to fight there, because he wanted to take the Palestinian fighters out of Tell us Za'atar, who basically were the Palestinian Liberation Movement, which he claimed for 4 years that he is protecting. And in 1982, and this is like, this was, I wrote this in the article, he wanted, like, there were protests in Syria and Yarmouk camp for like back then in 1982, because against Hafez al-Assad, because he caused a split and he divided the Palestinian the PLO after the Israeli invasion. Actually, Hafez al-Assad collaborated with the Israeli army and the Israeli invasion back then to kick the Palestinian Liberation Movement out of Lebanon, and the Israeli air jets were hitting the Palestinian Liberation Movement's bases at the same time that the Syrian army's tanks were hitting the PLO's bases. And because of that, Syrians and Palestinians, by the way, and there were press across the whole region, not only in Syria, but one of the press was in Al Yarmouk camp for Palestinian refugees in Damascus, where people started to chant, and I'll try to translate it as much as I can here, as accurate as I can. They started to say, a lion in Lebanon, and a lion in Lebanon, a mouse in Golan Heights. So, you know, Assad means lion in Arabic. Like Assad in Arabic, it means lion. So people were like saying, you are only becoming lion and you behave as a lion when you against the Palestinians and Lebanon, but your Golan Heights has been occupied for 15 years back then, 1982, and you are not shooting one bullet against the Israelis. So he's one of the most hypocrites that the history would ever see Hafez al-Assad, and then later on Bashar al-Assad. So in 1982, one of the secured the army, the Syrian army leaders, they were in a meeting, and in that meeting was my great uncle, who was part of al-Assad's crew back then, but he was on the opposite side of Hafez al-Assad. He was in the army, he was in the air force. So Hafez al-Assad said, one of the army leaders told Hafez al-Assad, this go and just shell al-Yarmouk camp and broke it, like, broke the, and kill people in their houses, just like this, destroy their houses over their heads. And I, like one of the people who like were in the meeting, he told my father the story that my uncle threw a coffee table against that guy, because my great uncle, he's a Palestinian. He said that you are saying that you're going to destroy the camp over the heads of my family. And Hafez al-Assad did not mind it, by the way, but there was kind of a resistance to Hafez al-Assad. He was not still, there was kind of still power outside of his hands. But the only thing that stopped him from doing that is like being my great uncle being there and some other leaders who opposed that. But instead, he arrested people in 1982 from the Palestinian camps across Syria and Lebanon who's lived their life. Some of them, maybe until now, they are in prison. One of the things that Hafez al-Assad, people I really, really should know about Hafez al-Assad, that at some point in 1969, when he was still the Minister of Defense, and then like he took over in 1970, so like one of the months that he left over between his position as the Chief of Army and or the Minister of Defense and his position as a President for Syria, that he arrested the leadership of the Palestinian Liberation Movement in that and put them in al-Mazzaf prison. And when the rest of the lead, like the Arab world leaders, started to call Hafez al-Assad and tell him, like, you arrested the leadership of the Palestinian Liberation Movement, man, what you doing? He put Yasser Arafat in prison. And he put Yasser Arafat's crew, Khalil Wazir of Jihad, who was assassinated in 1987, in prison. He put like the top leaders of PLO in prison in Syria. So when the other, when some Palestinians went to his, to the presidential palace, and they told him, you need to release them. These are the leaders of the Palestinian people. So he said, no, I'm not going to release them. So then when they were leaving, a man turned his back to Hafez al-Assad and he told him, the history will remember forever that Hafez al-Assad imprisoned the whole top leadership of the Palestinian Liberation Movement. And at that point, Hafez al-Assad started to think of releasing them, and he released Yasser Arafat and Khalil al-Wazir of Jihad, who was waiting like his wife to give birth back then. So. And then fast forward to his son Bashar al-Assad, when the revolution started and the protests broke out all over the country, including in the Palestinian camps, the Palestinian factions, they were supportive of Bashar al-Assad, but one of the things that they said, like they started telling people in the streets, the Palestinians, that you don't you engage at all. If you engage in the protest, you are on your own. We are not going to defend you. We are not going to help you to get out of prison. We just can't. One of the leaders, I remember him, he's like one of the leaders of PLO in Syria. He said, like, if I go to prison now, I cannot even help myself or find someone to help me. Even the Palestinian political structure leaders back then, they were worried of the security state that Hafez al-Assad and his son created, to an extent that they were worried about themselves. And this fear was translated by supporting Hafez al-Assad, some of the Palestinian factions in the left, and the right supported the help Bashar al-Assad, and this might have created an illusion or delusional idea in the left that, oh, since the Palestinian factions and PLO are supporting Bashar al-Assad, so maybe then Bashar al-Assad is a good guy and he's supporting the Palestinian liberation movement. But what people do not know, that the Palestinian political structure that was that is currently running the Palestinian lives is part of the dictatorship of in the region, is part of Putin's plan. Abu Mazen Mahmoud Abbas, he is the leader of PLO and the president of the Palestinian state and the president of the Palestinian Authority and the president of Fatah and the president of the Central Committee and the president of the core committee. He's the president of everything. He did not let the Palestinians. The Palestinian political structure today is just fundamentally part of this whole fabric that Putin supported and created over the years in the Middle East and North Africa. And it's just an expression how the West really failed in understanding the region and supporting the democracy movements that started in 2011 and ended up in this situation today. And this is part of like the, if we're gonna just inductively or deductively describe it, this is how it happened, like from like the support of the Palestinian movements who do not even represent the Palestinian people, that the left created these ideas, and the left has a lot of journalists who do not have conscience, they do not have, but they have a huge platforms, and they started to throw and to spread mis and disinformation on Twitter and websites and paid basically by regimes like the Russian regime and the Syrian regime and other regimes in the region. And then we find ourselves in this situation where the left is divided, but we also ignore the fact that the whole world is divided. It's not only the left, and the whole world is divided because of, I don't know what to call it, like we don't have norms. We don't have norms for what's right and what's wrong anymore. You know, like there's this sociologist like Durkheim. He has like very very good expression or description for situations like this. So he says that when societies or systems collapse, when they collapse, this whole structure collapses of a society or a community or a system or whatever, the norms are very fragile and they collapse the first. But the same second that this system collapses and the norms collapse, there's new norms that are being start to get built. But it takes a lot of time. And I think we are still living in the collapsing moment of these norms, and the new norms are yet to be built. And I think we feel it every day and everywhere in this world these days.
Listen, we normally end now, but we haven't even got the questions from the chat. So I think, Nadar, you can stay, and if Chris in the background can continue to host, I would like to continue. You know, I think what I get from this whole discussion is that the leaders in the formal left, you know, like in the Palestinian factions, in some of the groups, you know, in the West, you know, they've lost their way. And to build these new norms you're talking about, we got to have solidarity from below. I mean, if we're on the left, you know, we're about uplifting the exploited and oppressed. And you really got to talk to the exploited and oppressed across borders. And I think that's, you know, the kind of solidarity we need to extend and find out ways to build. But let's see if we can go to some questions that were asked in the chat. And I just have one more comment. I saw Amy L. Sachs say it's too bad we don't have more people listening. But, you know, people should understand that this is not everybody watches this live. Some go back and watch it on Twitter, Facebook. And we're on all these podcast forums after Monday. And, you know, every week we get about 500 people that listen or watch. And people can help expand that by, you know, sharing and reposting the podcast when it comes out. So if you're worried that we want more people to hear it, you know, get the word out. So anyway, let's see some of the questions that people have asked. Ashley R., I'm happy you escaped to be able to educate us here today, Nadal. So that's a comment. Chris Blankenhorn, can you discuss the importance of the right of return for Palestinians from your position as a stateless refugee?
Oh, man. Where do you want to start? I am stateless. For the parents who are stateless, for grandparents who died stateless. I don't think that they're like, I'm just going to try to make it very, very short and brief. And I don't think that there will be peace between the Israelis and Palestinians unless there is a fair and just solution for all Palestinian refugees. And this fair and just solution should be based on people's choice, not what the Israelis impose. It should be either these people who want to go back to their homes, they should be able to go, and people who want to stay wherever they are, they should be able to get like a very fair solution, like a citizenship or compensation. And when I say that people should go who want to go back to their homes and their homeland and their villages or cities where their grandparents or parents were kicked out from, I'm not exaggerating. I am one of people who I still have family in Nazareth. This is where my father was born, and he was 1 year old when Nakba happened. And in his house and his grandparents' house, his aunt stayed there, and her kids are living there now. And I don't know them. I've never met them. And I would like to go and know my family who I never met in Nazareth. People who think that Palestinians, when they talk about right to return, that it is something very symbolic. It's not something symbolic. It's something very, very sentimental and very emotional and very essential in our culture. Because, you know, like, we are the indigenous of this land. I can count for you like my ancestries, like, and go back to like to, from my mother's side, like to the 17th century, if I want. And it's all documented in the Israeli archives today. I found the photos for my great grandfather, who was a mayor in Jaffa or in Safed in Palestine back then. We have roots, and we Palestinians should have the right for the self-determination, no doubt. And I don't see Palestinians giving this up at all. I don't see that.
Waiting for the next question to come up. Here we go. Scout Trooper 164. Nadal, what are your views on the Ukraine war?
Well, when the war in Ukraine started, I was ready to fight a third world war. I think it's like I think that that Ukrainians, and back then when I had the social media, I was on Twitter, I wrote something. I wrote that like Ukraine, the war in Ukraine is gonna define the world that we will be living in for the next century. Because like you know, people are talking about the invasion of Ukraine in 2021, I think, right?
2022,
but we forget what happened in 2014, right? Because that was the big revolution that created the new Ukraine that Putin hates. The passion for democracy and the human rights and the freedom and etc. and all these norms that Ukrainians like. This is why they started their Orange Revolution. And it was an inspiration for and before that, 2014 and 2004 and before that. So actually, the Ukrainian revolution was one of the aspirations for the revolutions in the Middle East and North Africa. So yes, I think like the war in Ukraine is a justified war for Ukrainians to fight until they achieve what they want to achieve, and I think what's going on today by letting them fight on their own without the support, when the freezing the support in Congress is just a Trump way to come back to the White House, and it's a Republican fault, and it's shame. I can't imagine like people. If you get invaded, you have to fight. If someone comes to kick you out of your house, you have to fight for your house, because the house that you're sitting in is just like your home, it's your family, it's that you spend tears and blood to build it. And if someone comes to kick me out, I'm gonna fight. Yeah. It's as easy as this.
You know, there was a poll of Gazans done by that research institute in Ramallah. I forget the formal name, but it's a good polling institute. And this is before October 7th, like the week before. And they asked Gazans, was Russia's invasion of Ukraine justified? And 70% said no, which is not surprising for people that have been occupied. They would sympathize with the Ukrainians. And that's in contradiction of what some of the leaders of both PLO factions, like you talked about, and Hamas, were trying to win favor with Putin for their own reasons. So I just found that poll result very revealing.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the common sense of any of a humanity, and this is what we. What we count on, like to build the new world that we will live in. And the common sense of humanity is that what Putin did is wrong. It is a massacre against Ukrainians, simply. But I'll tell you what, because Zelensky, in one of his speeches, he said when he was asking the war to arm Ukraine, he called the Knesset in Israel, and he said that our fight is the same fight. So some people took this as like, okay, now he's not pro-Palestine, so we're gonna be pro-Ukraine. But I think this whole principle is wrong, because, and I'm not talking about who's asking, I'm talking in general, because like it's a big discussion we had and conversation, that it is the principle that we are discussing, not the person and what he's doing. The principle is invading another nation state is wrong, simply. If the Ukrainians invaded Russia, we will support Russia.
Chris Blankenhorn, the comment about a just peace makes me think about how the current conflict could be used, used to pressure an acceptance of an unjust peace, even if limited to Gaza, such as present proposals focusing on Israeli hostages, but not giving the same weight to the thousands of unjustly detained Palestinians.
It's not going to happen. I mean, It's impossible. Like, this might be like a deal, a procedural deal. Like, it's going to be a deal, like, for, it's going to calm the situation for like a few months, even not even a year. But a permanent solution, like, whatever happens in Gaza, happening in Gaza today, and whatever happens in Gaza tomorrow, is not going to solve the Palestinian question, and it's not going to solve the Israeli complex situation. This is how I see it, because it's Gaza is today, unfortunately, is the one of the worst episodes of the Palestinian struggle, but it's not the end of it, and it will not be. And the right of return of Palestinians is the backbone of the Palestinian cause, and whatever deal today is going to be a deal like to solve a situation, not the whole cause. Honestly, I'm not worried about it, because for one reason is it is now like this. The Nakba happened in 1948. Now we are in 2024. And the right to retain is still living until today. No one gave it up.
Okay, I think that having Nadal's banner up there is a signal that we got through the questions. And I appreciate Nadal staying longer. We could go on, but we try to keep these podcasts not too long so people don't feel like it's that big of a commitment of time. So I really appreciate you coming on. I think a lot of people learned a lot about, you know, the nature of the Syrian struggle and its relationship to the Palestinian struggle, relationship of popular movements to the state powers in the region and around the world. And I think, you know, you pointed to the big problem and, you know, in the international order now, we got states that are basically saying might makes right. And that includes the United States historically, an invasion of Iraq. And I mean, I could go through a whole litany of things it's doing. I wouldn't say that for Ukraine. I mean, my complaint there is they've been slow getting the weapons, and they're too afraid of, you know, escalation with Putin to the point where they've just given enough to the Ukrainians to not lose, but not to win and push the Russians out either. So, but that would take us, you know, for another hour and a half discussion. So why don't we leave it there for this week? And Nadal, I really appreciate you coming on. And, you know, I think we might have you back as things develop, because I think you bring a perspective that a lot of people don't hear. So that's it for this week. Next week, we'll go back to just question and answers on current events. Things are moving fast between, you know, the foreign aid to Israel and Ukraine, and they're linked together, which creates problems for progressives, I think. The Trump trials, he seems to be delaying things to the point where he could get reelected, and he will never get prosecuted, which is a sign of, you know, the kind of thing happening that might happen in this country, like has happened in a country like Syria. So there's plenty to talk about. So thanks everybody for being here. And if you think this was worth listening to, share it, repost it, let people know. And With that, everybody have a good week, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you so much, Shelly. I'm honored to be with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We got power, love.